Welcome back, Level One Coach Podcast. Drew Carlson. You'll hear from Mikhail in a minute. Today's episode, we're basically gonna just open it up with this. Tampa got eliminated in the first round. We've both studied them because we resonate a lot on teams and organizations that are playing the infinite game. And it takes a lot of conviction, and there's not a lot of teams doing it. It's very much a minority thing now, and we're going to maybe talk about some reasons and things will come up to the surface. But we wanted to open it with their GM, Julien Brisebois, was asked, your typical, you just lost in the first round or you didn't win the Stanley Cup press conference question, which was, like, do you consider the season a failure or whatever the question was? And essentially, he just clapped back with, we're fine. We're not going to light everything on fire. Like, we set this up intentionally. Our window is open for this long. And we did this on purpose. We don't need to fire our coach. We don't need to get rid of a bunch of players. And he just nonchalantly said, you know, we're good. And whatever happened, happened, and it's hockey. We're not going to, like, beat ourselves up over it. We are convicted in what we're doing. We know what our plan is, and we're just going to attack it next year. So let me kick it over to you. What were kind of your takeaways from that, and where does your mind go on that?
So for me, like, he mentioned something about, like, the role of luck. Like, we were, I don't know if he said we were the better team, but we were just as good of a team all series long. And we were unlucky in the sense that we lost a couple games in overtime, didn't get whatever you want to call bounces, calls, whatever it is. But very few GMs, coaches, media talking people mention the role of luck, but the role of luck is certainly at play. You got to be lucky to win a Stanley Cup, and you got to be unlucky to lose one, realistically. So there's that I like that he said. And then I also, what I like about that thought process is, like, the conviction it takes and the belief in what you're doing that you have to have in order to really get up there and say that. Because as soon as you lose at any level, you start second guessing yourself. Should we have played that goalie? Should we have changed this system? Should we have looked at what they were doing a little closer? Should I have hired that guy? Like, you just start going through all the decisions you make over the course of a year, 2, 3 years, and considering whether or not you should have done those things or you should have done things differently. And for a guy like him to stand up there after what the outside world would consider to be not a success, a failure, and that they didn't win the Stanley Cup and they didn't make it out of the first round, he sits there and is like, we're good. Like, we'll be back next year. This happens. This is life. This is sports. No big deal. And, like, I just think in order to really, he could be faking it, but everything about that Tampa organization, from Yzerman to Cooper to Lalonde to him now Brisebois, like, I think that seriously is a genuine staple of what they do. And it's not just words in a press conference. And so, like, you just really have to have a lot of belief in yourself and what you're doing and conviction in how you're going about it, that you truly are okay. You lost first round, but we'll be back. And I mean, I love it, because I think the knee jerk is, should we look at a different, I mean, at this point now, Cooper's like 2-time Stanley Cup winning coach. You're not going to fire him, but, like, some teams might. So for him, like, we're not going to look at getting rid of Cooper. We're not going to look at finding a different top line winger other than Kucherov or Stamkos, a different center than Point. Like, you're just like, we're going to double down on this. We won 2 Stanley Cups in the last 3 years. We were in the finals last year also. Like, I mean, let's talk about the fact that you played like 300 NHL games in the last 3 years. Like, that catches up to you. So we're good. We'll be back. And, like, I don't know. I think it just shows the conviction and the belief in what you're doing.
Yeah, it's that. And it's just what they also have is Sam Hinkie calls it like the longest view in the room. And he's a person that if he walks into a room, he has the longest view in the room. And what that essentially means is this completely zoomed out perspective on a very intentional plan. And like there are some teams, even in the NHL, probably, I don't know, I'm not there, but there are teams that are, you can kind of see it, they're very reactive year to year. They're making decisions on impulse. They're feeding into like media pressure, whatever the stakeholders, shareholders, stuff like that. And then there are teams like you have a Breezeball stand up in a press conference. And it just happened with Don Granato in Buffalo. And Don was asked the same question. And it was along the lines of, you were close to make, I think they were, you just said they were like 1 point out of making playoffs off the air. And
something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And he was like, the reporter was like, is it playoffs or bust next year? And he was taken aback because he knows that they're playing the infinite game. And the thing that I loved is that he like gave an answer and poured out his thought process, and he didn't just shrug it off. And what he said was, our window is open to make playoffs next year, and we expect to, and we want to, but if we don't, our system and what we've done and our alignment between GM and coach and organization, we have now set this up with certain player contracts to, if we don't make playoffs next year, it's not playoffs or bust. And I'm not going to lose my job, basically. And we're set up to make it the next year if we don't make it this next year. And we're set up to make it the year after that, and the year after that, and the year after that. And we did this on purpose. And we've given Buffalo some structure as an organization that didn't exist before we got here. And that's the infinite game. And that's having this long view and not being reactive and wondering if it's going to be playoffs or bust, or wondering if the head coach isn't going to have a job next year. Like, he knows that he's safe and he can, we talked about it a couple episodes ago, like that unlimits you and you're not in the self-preservation mode. And the five teams that are choosing to play the infinite game right now, and there's probably a few more than that. But like you look at the 76ers and Sam Hinkie, and what, if you're not clued into like basketball right now, he was trying to win an NBA championship this year, but he was trying to do it in 2015 when he was the GM. He wasn't trying to win the NBA championship in 2015. He was playing to win 10 years down the road, and he was setting all the pieces in motion and an intentional process to get to the point that they've now made the playoffs the last 3 years. So they have a chance every year now. But when he was laying that groundwork and he was playing the long game, they didn't have a chance in 2015. So what could he do to do what they're doing in Buffalo now? Do what they just did in Tampa, which is set something up intentionally with people in positions that felt safe, that weren't just going to lose their job after they had a terrible season in 2016, 2017, when they were struggling. But if you can compound all the advantages you're trying to build and see that all the way through, that's where you're seeing what Tampa did. That's where you're seeing what Buffalo's probably going to do. And we've talked about how Detroit's now kind of on that path, and Anaheim, if you want to kind of jump into any or all of that.
What comes to mind for me is how what you're saying about Tampa and Buffalo current, well, Tampa in the past, Buffalo, Detroit, and likely Anaheim currently, it's all boring because it takes so long. And like, I know it's a big, like in Philly, I think it was, right? Like the process, that was the whole like buzzword that they had.
Yeah.
Like the process, for anyone who is interested in the process in 2015, and I'm not a basketball guy, so like I can't really dive too deep into this, but like you probably got bored of the process by 2023, unless you're a Philly fan, you're still into it. But like all that stuff, all that shit that was funny back then is now like old news because it took too long. And now like I just Googled Sam Hinkie and the first video is idiot or genius. Like, it's like just that. Like, he's maybe an idiot because he's 8 years removed now, and they still haven't won. And it's like, I think that's where it's probably, it's just a, I would say a result of like the media culture, and also just like our, we are all guilty of it too. Like, we want that immediate gratification. We want that, like, all right, so like Iserman took over and he named Milan coach and they just rattled off a 60 win season and won the cup. It just doesn't work like that. It doesn't, like, John Cooper had to go through however many years in Tampa of losing, not losing every game, not losing, you know, more than he won, but losing in the playoffs, getting swept by the Blue Jackets 4-0 after being the President's Trophy winners and setting what was then a record before he then rattled off two cups. And now Detroit, like, they missed the playoffs this year. They were close, but not Buffalo close. So next year, maybe they'll inch a little bit closer. Maybe they'll get Buffalo close, 1 point out, which they were, I just checked, 1 point out. So maybe they'll get there next year, or maybe they'll barely squeak in. They probably won't win the Stanley Cup next year. I think if you asked Iserman, he'd say, I mean, I think we could, but I wouldn't be putting money on that. Not yet. It's all boring because it just takes a long time. And you got to be like a genuine, call it student of the game, learner, whatever, to like see the value in it and want to follow it. And I'm not even saying that you and I are. Sometimes I get bored of it too. And I certainly got bored of the Tampa stuff. I remember when they lost, I think in 15 to the Blackhawks, I want to say. I was like, what the hell, man, this team, like, I'm out on them. Like, you know, I was like a freshman in college. I was like, they lost with Stamkos and this Vasilevsky guy. Like, who the hell is this dude? Like, now 6-7 years later, like, they're the best team in the NHL for the last, all that period, last 7-8 years. So like, even I'm getting bored of this, and I consider myself to be like interested in learning about this kind of stuff and paying attention to it. So I think like a big piece of why we don't always key into the important insights that guys like Brisebois, Iserman, Cooper, is it Kevin Adams, right, in Buffalo? Mm-hmm. A lot like that these guys are doing is because it seriously takes time, and you actually have to be patient and pay attention and watch what they're doing from a distance. Because if you just want that 0 to 100, like, kind of success story that's in the movies, like, it's just not going to happen. And if it does, it's going to happen once every 50 years. And that's not replicable. That's luck. Replicable is like doing what Tampa has done. They've now positioned themselves as a powerhouse year after year after year for the last like 8 years. So that's way more desirable than being that overnight, quote, overnight success. But the overnight success gets a lot of attention in the media. It's popular. It's a great satiable story that you just want to read more about and hear more about. It makes you feel good, and it makes you feel like anyone can do it. But the truth is that, like, it's going to happen once every 50 years, once every 100 years. So you'd be better off trying to learn from a guy like Iserman, Brisebois, these guys that we keep mentioning, and try to pay attention to what they're doing, because you can probably learn a lot. It doesn't mean you can go out and do it yourself, but you can learn a lot from what they're doing and try to take bits and pieces from them. And that's likely going to position you or your team for more success than trying to hit that flash in the pan that's all over the news.
Yeah. And talk to me about, you were talking off air about, like, let's talk about kind of how it goes the other way and get into that. And you were talking about kind of what's going on with the Rangers right now. And just as many teams, or it's not even just as many, there are the infinite game is, in my opinion, the minority game being played right now in organizations. So talk to me about kind of what you're talking about with, like, just use the Rangers as an example.
Yeah. So Rangers obviously sold their soul for playoffs. I mean, had a sick team. Like, I think most people would have picked them to beat the Devils. And they lose in the first round. And Gallant had that press conference. I think they lost a week ago yesterday. So it must have been like a week ago today. And somebody asked him, like, are you worried about your job? And he was pretty defensive. Like, what do you mean? Like, we made the playoffs the 2 years I've been here. Like, no, I'm not worried about that. Like, and sure enough, like, they gassed him, whatever it was, like 2 days later. And I look at that and, like, I think a little bit of a side note, but not really. Like, the three Jack Adams Award nominees last year, which is for Coach of the Year, were Andrew Brunette, Daryl Sutter, and Gerard Gallant. Daryl Sutter was just fired by Calgary. Gerard Gallant was just fired by New York. And Andrew Brunette was not hired to be the full-time head coach with the Florida Panthers and now is an assistant with the Devils. I look at that and I'm like, either that award is rigged, or sorry, not rigged, that award is not real. It's not an accurate representation, or we are not doing a good job of believing in the guys that are supposedly the best. How did Gerard Gallant go from a Jack Adams nominee last year to done with a team that still made the playoffs? I mean, even Daryl Sutter, the one thing I'd say is that, like, Calgary missed the playoffs and there was somewhat of a debacle between Gaudreau leaving, Tkachuk wanting out. Like, you could say that some things like that played a role in it. But as far as Gerard Gallant's concerned, like, he got them back to the playoffs. Yeah, he didn't win the cup, but so did 31 other teams aren't going to win the cup this year. So, like, he's not in the minority there. So I look at that and I'm like, how does that happen? And to me, like, to answer your question, I think when you aren't sure or convicted in what you're doing and you don't have a ton of belief in what your either organization or team stands for, you get reactionary. You get that result where you fire Gallant, because if you don't fire Gallant, did you just think this year was a success? Are you okay with losing in the first round? Is that just what the Rangers stand for now? Are we not the 94 good old days of mess anymore? Like, you get all that kind of shit. And so you end up doing something, even if it's not the right thing, it's something. And so you fire Gallant. And, you know, now what are you going to do? Like, I don't know who they'll bring in. I mean, if I had to guess, it's probably going to be a guy who's coached in the NHL before. I wouldn't be shocked if Quenneville was cleared by the NHL that he would get that job. But now you're going to bring in a guy who's, for all intents and purposes, he's basically just Gerard Gallant with a different name. And not that he doesn't have his own skill sets and not that he doesn't have his own unique character traits that make him the coach he is, but, like, is he really that much better than Gallant? And did you really go outside of the normal hiring pool and get, like, David Quinn, like they did like 5 or 6 years ago from BU? I doubt it. I doubt they'll do that. And so to me, it's like, why did we fire him? Did we fire him because he needed to go and he was not the right guy for this job after only 2 years and two playoff runs, regardless of how they ended or how quickly they ended? Was he really just not the right guy anymore? Or did we need to do something to show all the stakeholders, the fans, the ownership group, whoever else is in that category, the players, that, like, hey, that we want to be better than this, so we're going to fire him? I think it's more that. And my only true issue, when I'm just sitting here from the complete outside, knowing nothing of the hiring process at the NHL level or anything with the New York Rangers individual thought process, my only true issue with that is that it's coaches that go first and then players. So if you're a player on this team, strike one's already been used. So strike two, like, you're up, buddy. Now you're, whether you're Mika Zibanejad, you're Jacob Trouba, you're Igor Shesterkin, it's you next. So am I confident and am I feeling good, or am I scared shitless? I'm probably scared shitless now that if I don't figure it out, or I don't do as well as they want me to do, or I don't live up to that contract I just signed, that now I'm going to be the next guy to go. And we kind of talked about this earlier in another episode, but that does not create psychological safety. That does not create an environment where you're free to make mistakes and free to play in a way that can make your team successful. Now you're kind of, you're terrified. So I guess to round that out, like if you're really, really convicted and you believe that Gerard Gallant is no longer the right answer for your team, by all means, find someone else. But if you're just doing it to do something, the second and third order effects that you're now going to have on your team, to me, are really detrimental. Because whether you're at the NHL level or the U16 level, players are people, and people pick up on this guy being fired, that guy being fired, and you know where you stand now, and you know how replaceable you are, just like he was.
Yeah, it leads me to think, and I wasn't clued in when I was a player to, I don't even know if like the original book about the Infinite Game by James Carse was out, but like there's no way I was reading that at, you know, as a college athlete. But like it didn't start getting super popular till Sinek jumped on with his book about it. But I'm wondering if players, and I think the answer is yes, I'm curious to think, or I'm curious what you think. But do you think players can kind of pick up on, and obviously they would have to be aware of the concept, but do you think players understand that they're in a finite organization versus an infinite one?
Absolutely. I think so. Because as a coach, you're going to be able to tell by the decisions that are made from those above you, whether you are or not. And that's going to dictate how you make decisions. So if you are, if you just start at the top, if you're a general manager and you know that, I'm going to go back to the Rangers example, you know that hiring, Rand Pecknold, that's just won a national championship, or David Carl in Denver, two recent national championship winning coaches in Division I. They do not have NHL head coaching experience. There's no debating that. They don't have it. So if you're Chris Drury with the Rangers and you go out and hire either one of them, it's a little bit of a gamble from the outside world. Like that guy he's never coached the Rangers or the NHL before. And so if you're Chris Drury and you do that and it works out, you're a genius. If it doesn't work out, you're now the Sam Hinkie genius or idiot. You're the idiot. So why'd you do that? 2 years from now, you hired David Carl. He didn't work out. Why'd you do that, man? You could have hired Joel Quenneville. You could have hired Daryl Sutter. You could have hired, and you just go down the list of all these other guys that have already coached the NHL. So if you're in that, I'm going to say finite mindset, finite organization where you're the GM, you don't want to lose your job. No one wants to lose their job. So are you going to take a big risk by hiring a somewhat inexperienced, quote, head coach for your NHL team? No, you're probably going to go to the well that you know is experienced. And if that doesn't work out in 2 years, your job isn't necessarily on the line, because you're going to say, hey, Joel Quenneville was the best candidate at the time. Like, I didn't know he wasn't going to work out here. He had NHL head coaching experience. He's won a Stanley Cup. Of course I thought he could do it. Daryl Sutter, whoever. So now 2 years later, you find yourself in the same spot and you make another decision and you bring in someone else. But you are safe. So I say all that because now let's go one level down to the coach. So Joel Quenneville was hired instead of David Carl or Rand Pecknold. Quenneville gets here and he looks at his predecessor and he goes, shit, Gallant was here 2 years. That's not a long time. So now I got 2 years to prove it. And prove it means like get to the cup finals, essentially. And if I don't do that, I'm probably out. So am I going to take time to let Kaapo Kakko develop, or to let Alexis Lafreniere develop? Or am I going to be like, dude, you need to figure it out now. I'm not waiting to develop. And if that means I trade you at the deadline to get whoever the equivalent of Patrick Kane is, or someone else like that at the, you know, that I think can help us win today, you can bet your ass I'm doing it. And it's honestly why a team like the Devil or a team like the Rangers probably goes out and does what they did at the deadline, where they sell their future for the current, because the odds that Gerard Gallant or Chris Drury are there in 5 years when they have to pay the repercussions are pretty low. So it's like, why not swing? Let's swing now. Gerard Gallant, I'm sure, was in favor of swinging for that. And even Drury, even if Drury is there, he might be like, it's still worth it, whatever. So point being, like, Quenneville doesn't have time to let some of these guys develop. He needs the results and the production now. So you tell me, is that a finite or infinite environment to be in? Like, that's that right there. The players are going to know, like, all right, so we need Kako to have the year of his life when he just honestly needs like another year to develop and learn and continue to get better and build off what he's been doing. But we're not going to allow him to do that. Well, now I know I'm in a finite game. And now I know I'm not safe because he wasn't safe and he was a first overall or second overall, whatever he was. He was a first, second overall pick and he wasn't safe. Like, I'm Tyler Mott. Dude, I'm not safe. And so I think the players know that. And I think the inverse of that is just use Tampa. We lost in the first round. We've never won a cup. We lost in the first round 4-0 to Columbus, who is an absolute sleeper, dark horse, whatever you want to call it. Not a team that should have won that series on paper by any stretch of the imagination. We just lost. We didn't even win a game. Did Cooper go? Nope. Did Kucherov go? Nope. And just go down the line. Nobody left. Nobody was traded. Nobody was whatever. Not a single guy. You know you're safe there. If you provide value and you do the things that your team or organization is asking you to do, whether the results follow directly on the tail of that or not, you're safe. And so I think the players know that. You can feel that. You can tell which environment you're operating in because the GM determines that, or owner determines that. The head coach knows, and the head coach is going to express that to the players. Not explicitly. He's never going to walk in and be like, guys, we're in a finite game. But all of his actions and words and his character, his like characteristics, like those are all going to exemplify a finite game or an infinite game. And as a player, you're going to pick up on that. So yeah, that's a long way to answer your question, but absolutely. I think players know.
No, it was worth it. Cause while you were talking about it, I just had like another insight pop into my head about maybe a potential like signal or indicator for players that which kind of game they're in. And we talked about where I'm going a bit off air. But the thing that I wrote down was the dead giveaway for players might be, where is the next coach coming from? So what I mean by that is, and it just happened with Anaheim. So we can use them, for example, and switch gears. But Anaheim's organization just hired Matt McIlvain, who I've done a little bit of writing on in a three-part series about the Infinite Game, because he comes from an organization with Red Bull that, whether it's their soccer side, which Jesse Marsh was in, or their hockey side, which Matt McIlvain was in, like their organization with multiple levels of teams at different levels in Europe are all playing the Infinite Game, and it is aligned. So when you are kind of that person, and there are coaches that resonate a lot with that and want to be a part of that, and then there are coaches that probably don't want anything to do with it, and they're used to, what can I do to win now? What can I do to win this year? Because that's what a lot of the sound bites are. A new coach takes a job and is like, we're going to compete for the Stanley Cup next year. Like, are you? But with the Infinite Game and those players that are attracted to that game, they don't care about that stuff. And they want to be a part of a machine that eventually will get results. And those results don't have to happen next year. And they don't care if they happen next year. And if there's an understanding that, like, here's the thing that I think about, and maybe a lot of, definitely the teams that aren't playing the Infinite Game don't realize, is there's a compounding effect to almost everything in this world. So if you're plucking your next coach from your AHL affiliate, and this will get back to the question that I asked, players are wondering, or players might be able to wonder or know which game your organization's playing based on where the next coach is coming from. Is he coming from a different NHL organization after he's been fired twice in the last 3 years from two different teams? Or are we bringing him up from our AHL team? And what might be the advantage to that is the NHL is getting younger. And there, if Matt McIlvain is the next head coach of the Ducks, if that's on the table, just like when, so like Jeff Blashill, I think the Wings were kind of maybe the first to do it. That comes to the top of my head. He was the coach in Grand Rapids, and the understanding, whether it was, you know, like a Liam Neeson, we have an understanding, or whether it was explicit, he was going to be the next coach of the Wings one day. And I think if more teams adopted that, there's this compounding of trust and relationships that happen because the league's getting younger and more guys are coming up from the AHL. Like Jeff Blashill probably coached, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I bet 50% of the Wings roster during his Red Wings tenure, he coached previously in Grand Rapids. So now instead of a new coach coming in day one of training camp from a different NHL team going, we're going to do this now, Jeff Blashill and guys that have come from the A to the NHL in the same organization can now say, we know what works. We're convicted, going back to that point. We have a plan, and I'm going to continue to leave this place in a better position than I found it, and we are going to play the infinite game, and this is why I came from the level that I came from, because I believe in this organization. I believe in you guys. I've coached a ton of you guys already, and we're just going to keep building instead of chop everything down, start from scratch, get someone from a different organization, and let's blow everything up. So that, again, is kind of a long-winded way of circling back to players understanding where is your next coach coming from, and that might lead you to believe, I'm in an infinite organization, and I'm going to be trusted here, and I feel safe here, and I'm going to be able to put my best foot forward, or I'm walking on eggshells, I might be next, I'm in this fear-based mindset. So if you want to add to any of that, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good cue because, like you said, not only are you going to know if you played for the Wings and Blashill was your head coach when you're in Grand Rapids, like you know what he's like and what he stands for, but he also knows the ins and outs of the organization, which I think is a benefit to the players ultimately, versus bringing in someone from the outside. And not that someone from the outside can't do well. But it's interesting, like Cooper followed that same path. I'm pretty sure Bednar did as well. And maybe I'm cherry picking a little bit because it's just the past two Stanley Cup winners. But I really do think that there's something to be said of like you're cultivating your own talent. It's no different than what you want to do with the players. Like, you know, when you draft, I'm trying to think of an NHL player who spent some time in the minors before, like, I'm struggling to think of one? Yeah. Yanni Gorba. I don't think Yanni Gorba was drafted. Was he?
Yeah, fair enough.
I'm trying to, like, I guess, I think Alex Killorn that may work. But I was trying to think of someone outside of Tampa just because we always talk about them. But that's fine. Alex Killorn is an example of, like, you draft Alex Killorn from Harvard or from juniors if it was before that. Like, you don't then send him to Chicago's AHL team. You send him to your AHL team. And then you develop him, allow him to grow, and hopefully cultivate his talent within your organization, and then you promote him to the NHL. Every team does that. Like, you never are going to send X draft pick to a different NHL organization's AHL team. You're always going to keep him from within. Why don't we do that with head coaches? Why, or assistants for that matter? Why don't we... We would never, if we needed to call a guy up mid-year, we're going to take a guy from our AHL team. Now, I know mid-year is different than in the summer when you can find another guy who's out of coaching now, but that same mindset applies, where like if you are now the New York Rangers, for example, like I don't know, I believe their AHL affiliate is Hartford, and I don't know who the Hartford head coach is, although I have seen a couple things of like he would be a good candidate. And maybe he is the front runner, but like if he's not, why isn't he? Why isn't he one of the top candidates that you're looking at? Because he's worked with all your players, whether it's NHL now or AHL now, between development camps and summer stuff. Like he knows the guys on the NHL team. He's worked with them before. They know him. He knows the prospects that are right now in the AHL. He knows what your organization stands for. He's spoken with Chris Drury on multiple occasions about X, Y, and Z thing. And that was like Ryan Warsawski, who was an assistant at Curry years before I was, but we've talked about him before. I think he's now the assistant with San Jose Sharks. He was the head coach in the AHL for the Chicago Wolves, who I think is actually changing, but they have been the Carolina Hurricanes affiliate in the AHL. And yeah, so like I remember talking to him last summer, and he was like, yeah, I talked to Rod Brendamore a lot, like weekly, about different players, and we run the same, I think it was the same D zone that they do, so that when guys get called up, they know how to do it. Like, how much congruency is there just in that alone? It's like beautiful. Like, hey, if Rod Brendamore ever got fired, which seems unfathomable, but if he ever did, wouldn't you want Warsawski, who is the AHL head coach, who's been doing the same thing Rod has, who knows what we're trying to do and knows the team? And I see the flip side where like, well, we just fired him. Why do we want his little mini me? Okay, maybe that's true. But even if he's not, even if he's working for the AHL affiliate of that NHL team, he's still his own person. He's his own coach. He's got his own style. It's not going to be a copycat of the guy that you just got rid of. So I don't know. I think with like, we talk about alignment and trying to figure out like where guys fit best, in attracting the right type of player and attracting the right type of coach to your organization. Like, you got to think that there should be more consistency with, if this guy is our AHL head coach, and you brought up McElveen in the beginning of this, like, if he's our AHL head coach, are we going to groom him to one day be the NHL head coach? It doesn't mean next year. It doesn't mean even 5 years. It might be 10 years down the line before he's ready. But do we want to do that, or do we want to lose him to a different team? And I look at it like, you never want to lose your first rounder to a different team for whatever reason. So you should treat your coaches in that same light, from assistant coaches to head coaches. And if you did that, you create like the Jim Collins good to great flywheel. And it just never ends. And now John Cooper's going to leave, and they're going to hire his assistant or the Syracuse head coach who's been working under Cooper's tutelage for years. Like, that just, I don't know, maybe I'm an idealist, but that just makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, like, from first principles, and we'll talk about a team that I've studied a lot, like, my brain immediately jumps to the Chicago Steel. But you don't interrupt the compounding if you're playing that game, and if you're pulling guys up from if you're pulling your next coach from the AHL instead of from the outside. And like how Chicago has worked since Ryan Hardy was hired, who's now gone, but their process hasn't changed because the next guy up believes the same thing and they have alignment. So like when you look at Chicago's coaching staff over the last 4 years, the only people that have come in as assistants. So they're coming in from the bottom, and then they're working up that hierarchy. So Greg Moore was the head coach, the first one. When he moves on mid-season without skipping a beat, they're like, Brock Sheehan's our guy. Their owner even said, I wrote about this in the book, like their owner has a bit in the press conference that was like, we made this decision because we knew Greg was going to move on eventually. Like, he's a rock star. We knew this day was coming, and we knew immediately our guy was already here. And I think the best teams operate with, there is a next guy in our organization already that we believe in, that will not interrupt the compounding, that knows the players, that knows the system, that believes in the system, that wants to be here. Why would you go elsewhere? And then Brock moves on to the AHL, and Mike Garman who was the acting GM at the time, who started as an assistant coach, just moved places in the organization, becomes the head coach and GM. And if Mike ever moves on, whether it's this year because they're having success again and everyone wants to steal their people, like, there's still a coach from that original staff, Matt Deschamps, who was an assistant the first year under Moore. That's still there, and he'll be the next guy up. Like, you can put money on it that he'll be the next coach of the Steel based on how it's been going and how they operate. And the only people they bring in new are assistant coaches. And then they stay until they're the head coach, and then they go to the AHL. So if you want to jump in there at all.
Yeah, like, I think that's kind of the blueprint we're talking about. Like, they kind of embody, not kind of, they do embody that path or mindset really well, where like you said, like, you still currently now, like, what is it, 5 or 6 years later, have one of the original coaches on that staff. So you're always in a position, ideally, to perpetuate this culture and system that you've created. And now, say Deschamps does get the head coaching job there, then now you'll have some openings where, like, some of these new assistants are going to come in and they're not maybe going to have known what it was like in the past or have been there for all of the years. But now, like, hopefully and ideally and probably definitely, Deschamps has learned enough over the last 6 years, whatever it is, from Moore, from Garmin, from Sheehan, that he can teach this like the back of his hand. He doesn't need to, there's no crash course he needs to learn. He knows it. So now he can just perpetuate this too. And he's there a couple of years as a head coach. He moves on, assistant, boom. And, like, I mean, there's a reason that those sorts of organizations, like, whether it's them in the USHL, Tampa, they have success, because it's very, I think of it as, like, once you come up with your hard and fast principles and theories and culture that you want to live by, it's hard to mess it up when everyone knows what you stand for, what you don't stand for, and how you go about accomplishing it. You can have anyone who's learned it run it, and you promote internally because you trust them to accomplish that. And the last thing I would say is, I think it's Sinek talks about the, or it may be Collins in that same book, A Degree, that I referenced earlier. Like, they talk about the sign of a, I think it's Collins, the sign of a successful organization is not just an organization that has a great stretch when X guy is their CEO or leader or head coach. The sign of a truly successful organization is one that can withstand and still prosper under leadership change. And no matter who's running it, they stay at the top despite that, what could potentially be very catastrophic change when you go from one leader to the next. So the Steel are like an absolute crash course in that. As much as we talk about Tampa, like, it still has been John Cooper for however many years now. The Steel have had now 3 different head coaches in however many years, and have still been able to achieve really high levels of success every year. So that's a actually great example of what we're talking about.
Yeah. And the thing that I jumped to there that I wrote down was, like, picture, like, split test this, finite and infinite, and we just talked about the Steel. So, not that, and I mean, in great cultures, let me preface by saying, in great cultures, they actually live the shit that's on the wall instead of just having words on the wall. But imagine, like, the Chicago Steel room and whatever their principles are, whether it says integrity, character, whatever. Just imagine, we've all seen an NHL room with that on the wall, and you have your 3 or 4 principles, whatever. That room hasn't changed in 6 years. That messaging hasn't changed in 6 years. That culture hasn't changed in 6 years. So then you take a team that has fired their coach 3 times, has made 3 coaching changes in 6 years. Let's say that. The room has to get repainted every 2 or 3 years. And there's new words on the wall. And whether they're being followed or not, again, we can get in, like, that's a whole nother rabbit hole of whether it actually matters or it's just words on the wall, because a lot of places it is. But anyway, the point is, picture two rooms. One is not changing, and there's compounding going on there. And one is getting a new paint job every 2 or 3 years, and there's new words from this new person that they're not, like, we talked about this off air a couple weeks ago, and we can go there if you want. But, like, when these Division I teams that have existed forever, so don't think of, like, Arizona State as your example right now. Think Colgate, Harvard, somewhere like that, where there's, quote, tradition. But if you hire a coach from the outside that's going to go change the locker room wall or wants to put his own stamp on thing, then, like, it's not Harvard anymore. You might as well change the name of the school. So we think that we're, and we even say it in the press conference, we want to, like, uphold the tradition. And then as soon as you change coaches from outside and do something that the Chicago Steel aren't doing, what traditions left? What torchbearers are left? Who's left on that staff that is mission and vision aligned with what you've been doing the past 4, 5, 6 years, however long it was, if you want to jump in on that at all?
Yeah, it's, I hadn't really thought of that with, like, the words on the wall and everything, but it is true. It's like that hasn't changed now in 6 years for the Steel, and for other places that are kind of operating that same light. Like, you've now, whether it's college or pro or junior or whatever it is, like, you've had a lot of consistency over the last however many coaching changes when you are promoting from within, and that allows you now. I think it allows your players, like we talked about earlier, to know what to expect and to understand, like, this is what you said, like, Colgate or Harvard, like, this is what, like, Colgate hockey or Harvard hockey stands for. And it's always been like this, even if it was a different coach 5 years ago, like, this is what we've always lived by. And I think it's, if you have a new coach come in constantly or frequently, those change, those priorities change. Those words change, the culture and, like, the legacy changes a little bit, and that gets confusing, and it also becomes unrecognizable for those that were there before. So if you were a part of, I mean, honestly, like, in a good way, but if you were part of the Steel 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you probably look at the Steel now and are like, whoa, that's night and day. And it goes the same way for college, NHL, whatever. Like, you look at certain teams that have gone through coaching changes recently, and what they were like before those coaching changes, probably vastly different. And it could be good, like we're saying with the case of the Steel, it could be really good. But other places, it could be like alumni don't even recognize that place anymore. And again, if it's a good change, so be it. That's positive. But if it's a net negative or even, would we have been well served to look with from within and see how we could continue what was started here? I don't know. It's an interesting, it does. The more we talk about it, the more I do see the flip side of, like, well, if you're firing someone, that means you don't want that anymore. So I see that part of it too. But I don't know. I think that I think we lean really heavily in the coaching profession towards, like, firing quickly and hiring what we consider to be the next best thing. And if we were slower to fire and also slower to look to the outside to hire, we might find that we end up firing less. Obviously, because I said we're slower to fire, but also because we give a little bit more thought and we don't necessarily knee jerk that Joel Quenneville's on the market. We got to snatch him up before he's gone. Again, nothing against Joel Quenneville. It's just like, what about that guy in Hartford? Like I talked about earlier, like, he deserves a shot. Could he do a pretty good job? Do we even know? Like, he's never had a shot in the NHL, I'm assuming. So, like, yeah, that's sort of answers your question, but that's where my thoughts go with that.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and wrap it up there. And, we'll see you guys on the next one.